Honolulu's Kaka'ako Waterfront Park will be closing on Sunday. Timing for reopening, uncertain. Future plans still in progress. We'll get some details when we talk with the CEO and Executive Director of the Hawaii Community Development Authority, Jesse Suki. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson says communication channels are open with North Korea, but how would that communication work? Some perspective from retired Lieutenant General Dan Leaf, former Deputy Commander and Acting Commander of U.S. Pacific Command. And nearly 100 years after the death of Hawaii's last monarch, a look back at the Queen. Noe Tanigawa talks with Jonathan Osorio about a painful history and a positive legacy that lives on today. It's Friday, October 6th, day 10 of our Fall Pledge Drive. Those conversations and more right after the news. Honolulu's Kaka'ako Waterfront Park is closing this Sunday. State Sheriff's deputies will clear nearly 200 people living there illegally, and the timing to reopen the park, that remains uncertain. I spoke earlier this morning with Jesse Suki, the Executive Director and CEO of the Hawaii Community Development Authority, and asked him what it was that pushed him to the point of decision to close the park.
Well, it's been a crescendo of illegal campers building up in the park, and we don't have authority as HCD and managers of that asset, 44 acres, to physically remove people because we manage the park. We're not law enforcement. We're not the social services or the homeless coordinator, so we don't have that outreach program or component. So we rely on those entities to assist us with those areas of helping with those issues. But I think because there's been a ramp up of these clearing areas on other properties with the city and the Department of Transportation and the Department of Land and Natural Resources and other parts of the island, we've seen the number of illegal campers slowly build up over the past months, and we've been tracking it. And we've been trying to keep up best we can with management, fixing broken, exposed wires. There's about 30 poles now with exposed wires on them. What happens is they'll hook up their extension cords to it and then run it to their tents, and there's broken water pipes. And the water mixing with the electrical is not safe. There's a lot of increased loose dogs. We get every so often gruesome pictures of dog bites from runners who use the park. So, you know, it was 50 and then it was 100. And it hit a 180 and 120 camps, and we just couldn't keep it open. It was not safe. And so we closed the waterfront park for public health and safety. And since we were closing that large park, we took the opportunity to do some management work and close the Gateway and Kewalo Basin parks. Now, it's not going to all be closed for a long period of time. We're looking at phasing the openings so that once we're done with our management work, the turf, the landscaping and that sort of thing, cleaning up the restrooms at Kewalo Basin, we'll slowly open up those parks first. But we're thinking that the waterfront park will probably remain closed for a longer period. It's going to take us some time to assess first what the damage is. Once the homeless coordinator does its outreach and the sheriffs assist with clearing trespassers, the park's closed, it's criminal trespass to be there. Once the park's cleared out, then we can take a real assessment of what all the damage is.
And what's going to be an indication to you that it's okay, that it's time to reopen?
So for the management parks, that's where we're looking at the Gateway Park and the Kewalo Basin. That'll be open sooner because that's really just managing some of the turf. We had some big events there. So we want to take care of that. For the waterfront park, we'll know when it's ready. We're going to prioritize the work we're doing. So the exposed wires, we want to fix and reinforce that so it's not so easy to break open again. Fixing the water pipes, once we fix that, that'll be good. There's this thing called a backflow. You know, not to get too explicit on air, but it's what prevents when you flush your toilet that from backing up into your potable water. It's a very, very important mechanism, and that's been tapped and broken. They'll attach a spigot to it so they can attach a hose. So we need to fix those health and safety things first. And the stuff like the turf, there's a lot of dead grass, you know, that part of the park because of the tents, and they'll break the sprinkler head so the tents don't get wet.
But as you say, your intention is to do a phased approach on the reopening. You know, back to this point on enforcement. Some of the things that you mentioned in terms of the wires, even the dogs running wild. We had a staffer here at HPR who was attacked by dogs there while she was running. But this question, I think a lot of folks don't understand, well, what's the deal? Why don't people call the cops? Why doesn't that get taken care of?
Well, so during the day when the park's open, mm-hmm. We do have park rules, and we call those civil rules, which is to distinguish them from criminal rules.
And who enforces that, by the way?
So the civil rules, we as HCDA staff mm-hmm. will go out in the park, and under civil rules we'll inform people, hey, you know, you can't have stakes in the ground, for example, and you can't have certain size tents and that sort of thing. You can't have open fires. We'll issue a citation if they choose not to comply, because mm-hmm. all we want is compliance. And usually a fine is attached to that if it's pretty bad. So we have those options. But we can't remove people. And as you can see, it's not very helpful to just have only that type of civil enforcement. Now, when the park closes at 10 p.m. and mm-hmm. opens up at 6 a.m., between mm-hmm. those hours, mm-hmm. it is criminal trespass into recreational and park property under our statutes. So we don't enforce criminal statutes. That's something that law enforcement has to do.
But this is also – it's not HPD, right?
You know, it could be HPD. It could be the sheriff. You know, there's different law enforcement entities involved potentially. Unfortunately, that's beyond our control, you know, what happens there. We do have our security, who is an extension of us, in the mm-hmm. park at night. And so – the security can't also physically remove people or issue a criminal citation for trespass. So they call up 911, and we haven't seen any clearing of folks who are there. It's very challenging.
And that's, I guess, for a lot of folks, a point of confusion in terms of jurisdiction about this. And you see this in a lot of places around Honolulu about, you know, this area is city, this area is state, this area is under some other entity. How is that, in terms of the waterfront park, another layer of challenge in managing that?
Yeah, HCDA is unique. The Hawaii Community Development Authority, we have currently three jurisdictions. You know, we could have more. The legislature creates them. They'll draw lines around a district and create it by statute, and then we're required to manage it. And the extent of our management is creating a community development plan with the community. Having that approved by the board and the governor becomes a plan. We adopt rules to implement that plan. And it's a land use overlay. Mm-hmm. So our primary mission is land use in a way that's consistent with the plan for economic development, social benefit, housing, and that sort of thing. We have another power that we have used in the past. We've invested $250 million about in improvements to infrastructure. And the park was one of those infrastructure improvements. And under that infrastructure improvement program, we call them improvement districts, what usually happens is that the road that we improve or the sewer or water main we improve, or in this case the parks, they're conveyed over to the city because we don't have at HCDA a highways program or a parks program, and we don't collect property taxes. So that $250 million we put into the district, which raises about $40 million in property taxes a year, we don't see any of that. That goes to the city. So if the park was to be turned over to the city at some point, then the city would be able to manage the park, and I would say better than HCDA can, just systemically. It's not an issue of my staff are great, but you know, we manage the park with contracts, which is not a good way to manage parks. You need a program.
You know, that's your background. You're a land use attorney. You previously have worked in policy planning, and you bring that planning perspective to a lot of what you do. When you look at the longer term and a longer term plan for this park in this area, where do you want to get to? What do you see?
So again, we're a land use management organization. Mm-hmm. We invest in developing community and then turning it over to the proper jurisdiction for long-term management. But there's a lot of powers that are outside of our control, extrinsic pressures that we have to address. You know, ultimately, what happens to the park is a larger discussion that happens. If we are to keep the park, I think, at HCDA, we would need to create, I think, a parks program. And a parks program would mean getting funding for a program, bringing on a parks director, bringing on a couple of parks management staff. You know, maybe because we don't have a police force like the city has. You know,
right.
So for their parks, you know, they have HPD, they have the Department of Facility Maintenance to help with management, they have a parks department. So we'd have to create those elements at HCDA. But, you know, to be quite frank, I don't think there's an appetite for creating more programs and positions and expanding government. So I think the more efficient way would be to, at some point, convey the park to the city.
Turn it back over.
But in the meantime, you know, we do have the board has an approach, and we're working on an approach which is three legs of a stool, if I could use that metaphor. One is to have our parks update plan approved, which the board's been evaluating and staff has been working on. That would make some physical changes that would allow us to have more body heat at the park.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, fix the open door amphitheater, for example. The second leg would be activating the park, getting more people in the park,
mm-hmm.
activities. You know, we're hoping that we might get one of the fiestas there, the big community events.
Right.
And then the third part is enforcement and outreach. And that part of it is – that requires coordination on our part, because that's not something we control or have powers over. So, you know, we depend on other agencies like Department of Health and Human Services, homeless coordinator, sheriff to help
right.
out with that part.
Jesse Suki, thanks for coming in. Jesse Suki is the CEO, Executive Director of the Hawaii Community Development Authority. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. We hope to open the parks very soon.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Handcrafted Restaurants, celebrating the craft of food, drink, and merrymaking at Monkey Pod Kitchen by Merriman in Ko'olina, Oahu, and Wailea, Maui, and at Moku Kitchen, now open in Kaka'ako.
This is The Conversation. North Korea remains a global puzzle point, and a dangerous one. Despite international pressure, the country has continued to conduct nuclear tests and fire missiles. But when it comes to communication, there's a lot that remains unclear. Retired Air Force Lieutenant General Dan Leaf has some perspective on this issue. He served as Deputy Commander of U.S. Pacific Command and has also been Director of the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu. I asked him for his view on the nature of communication with North Korea.
Well, it could work through unofficial or official channels, Bill. There is communication, I'm certain, between the two governments, probably sporadic, but as long as we have it, we should use it in the United States' interests.
And how important is that idea of direct communication, and is that something that needs to be on, if not a regular basis, but have some degree of routine to it?
I think it needs to have some degree of routine for when things become not routine, for when a crisis hits, when we're at a tipping point. If you haven't established channels, if you don't have somebody to call and you're trying to get a message across, either we are or North Korea is, then you're kind of at a loss. So I think it's very important, and it could yield progress that we haven't seen in recent years.
When it comes to the idea of progress and pushing things ahead with North Korea, what kind of an approach should the U.S. be taking at this point?
I think the approach should be fundamentally realistic and practical. We should have realistic expectations about communicating with North Korea. We're not going to solve the dilemma, the quandary of North Korea that's existed for decades with a single phone call or meeting, but we can make progress, and any progress made that gets us away from the very dangerous stalemate we currently have would be fundamentally good. I believe that. We also have to be realistic. These are North Koreans. They don't act by international norms in any regard, and they're often deceitful and don't adhere to what they might agree to. So we shouldn't expect them to suddenly change that behavior and be totally forthcoming and compliant in whatever agreements are reached. It's still worth talking.
And in terms of public commentary, and I'm thinking of the president at this point, but rhetoric, how dangerous or relatively not dangerous is the degree of rhetoric? Is this something that it's important to pay attention to, or is this something that's of less substance than may meet the eye?
I think it's of great substance, and I think it's fundamentally not dangerous, which may make me an outlier. The North Koreans have indicated publicly and through back channel that they're confused, that they don't know what to expect. And I'm pretty sure that's a good thing, that they can't expect business as usual and know that whatever action they get will get a predictable reaction from the United States. And secondly, we have to remember that the president's rhetoric is likely targeted at one audience and one audience only. He's talking to Kim Jong-un. He's not talking to Hawaii Public Radio or the American public or the world community. He's speaking to Kim Jong-un and saying, here's the deal. It isn't business as usual. I'm willing to consider new solutions, but I'm not willing to put up with your provocations on the basis that they've been executed for decades.
You know, speaking of things that have been executed for decades, certainly in varying degrees, sanctions. They have not seemed to be tremendously effective to this point, at least from the outside world. The Russians and the Chinese both have indicated they'd block any attempt to shut down oil shipments to North Korea. Short of that, what's your view of how we should look at sanctions when it comes to North Korea?
Well, it is. I have somewhat of a bifurcated view in that I don't think sanctions have worked or are likely to be a panacea for the situation, but they're absolutely necessary. They're absolutely necessary because the world community cannot say everything you're doing is fine, North Korea, whether it's nuclear weapons or human rights violations, and not impose some penalty. We have to impose penalties on the basis of their illegitimate withdrawal from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. So the sanctions have to be there, but I don't think they're going to be the cure. They might be a small part of the cure.
There's also an argument, though, that says that sanctions that have the stronger the bite, the further that degree of isolation, the further that degree of, as you have mentioned, underlining a sense of victimhood, really, for Kim Jong-un.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that sanctions against North Korea, while they may increase the degree of difficulty of getting funds for their weapons program or for whatever they might use them for, really serve some purpose for the North Korean leadership. In one sense, they increase isolation, and the more isolated the population is, the more dependent they are on the Kim dynasty for everything. In a second sense, they allow them to continue the narrative of victimhood that is fundamental to the regime's legitimacy with their population. North Korean government officials, the whole government, portrays itself as, first of all, the best answer, the right kind of communism, the solution to North Korea's problems, and it's only these outside parties that keep us from being successful. So they have to have that sense of victimhood for their legitimacy. And finally, I don't think they're likely to be fully effective because North Korea has found so many ways for decades to work around them. They get capital from a variety of sources. They traffic in narcotics. They print counterfeit money. They sell arms. They export, in essence, slave labor to Russia to do logging, and as a recent Associated Press article showed, to China to work in factories where the government takes up to 70% of their wages and sends it back to the government to use on whatever, I think probably nuclear weapons. And in that case, in the China case alone, it's estimated that that's $200 to $600 million a year. So those are totally unaffected by sanctions. And North Korea has found ways to work around the sanctions through those illicit means. finally, I think the bottom line is that they're very resilient, the North Koreans. And sanctions cause privation in some sectors of, say, society and create challenges for the government in raising the funds they need to do whatever they're attempting to do. But the North Korean population is unbelievably resilient. And all we have to do is look at the famine of 1994 to 1998 and look at how they endured that. So sanctions would isolate and impoverish a nation that's already perhaps more isolated and impoverished than perhaps any nation on Earth. I don't see that continuum progressing to breaking point, and I'm not sure we want a breaking point.
Retired Lieutenant General Dan Leaf has served as Deputy Commander and Acting Commander of U.S. Pacific Command, currently Managing Director of Phase Minus One LLC, providing thought leadership in conflict resolution, national security, and defense technology. Thanks for joining us, sir.
My pleasure, Bill. Aloha, and best wishes for the pledge drive to all your listeners. This is a good time to pledge to a great resource for the community in Hawaii.
Thank you, and aloha.
Aloha.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Impact Hub Honolulu Co-working.
It is an Aloha Friday on The Conversation, so that means we're going into the letter bag and sharing your comments and emails. In response to the AAUW study on student gender and the pay gap, Dexter Rusty wrote in and said, "I think the real problem is students taking on too much debt. These loan payouts should be made directly to the colleges. I know of people that have student loans that lived off campus, partied, traveled, got tattoos, and bought new cars all on student loans, and now they complain. Also, we need more students in degrees that actually benefit society, really. How many anthropologists, sociologists, and liberal arts majors do we need? We need problem solvers, not more people doing some research for 20 years at government expense on useless ideas." And we got this on the talkback line.
Hi, this is Kalika from Kauai. I think the state should do a better job in informing the public, and in case of a possible missile attack on the islands, regarding a possible signal of warning. I've not heard anything about this, and so I'd appreciate for the state to accept its kuleana to get with it and inform the public of what the signal might sound like, etc. So these are simple issues which the government should immediately address. Thank you for listening to my concerns.
My name is Nicole Albright. I'm calling from the Big Island of Hawaii, and I wanted to comment on all of the helicopter tour companies that are operating on the Big Island, Blue Hawaiian, Paradise, Safari. And, yeah, it's a growing business, and there's more Japanese coming every day, mostly to the west side of the island. Unfortunately, the helicopters are flying over the east side of the island, sometimes every 1 and 2 minutes all day long. So, again, I think it would be really great if helicopters could fly offshore, and then they could just fly way out over the ocean. The companies suggest that that's going to cost them more money, but, yeah, why don't they bear that burden? Why don't they bear that cost so that they can function here on the Big Island in a way that works for everybody?
And we're going to be taking up that issue of helicopter flight tours on the Big Island next week on The Conversation with Hawaii Island Coalition Malama Pono. Thanks for the feedback. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or reach out via social media, Facebook or Twitter, or you can call our talkback line. Leave us a message, 792-8217.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Sacred Hearts Academy, and Urgent Care Hawaii.
Jonathan Osorio is a professor of Hawaiian studies, and he's interim dean at Hawaii Nui Akea School of Hawaiian Knowledge. We're talking about Hawaii's Queen Liliʻuokalani today, who died 100 years ago this November. John, take us back to that day in January 1893 when American businessmen called for U.S. troops to help overthrow Hawaii's government.
I still think that her stand in the palace on January 17th, when her own military advisor was advising her basically to advance against the political dissidents who were basically holed up in the building across from the palace. And he told her, you know, we have the guns, we have the men, let us go and arrest them. And when she asked the question, what about the American troops, her marshal said, you know, I don't think that they will interfere, but if they do, we should shoot them down. And her response to this was that she would not shed the lives of her people. Based on that, based on her unwillingness to have her own people subjected, and she could not predict what they might do to her. She willingly gave herself up. They could have executed her. They did imprison her. They subjected her to all kinds of humiliations, but she took that. And she considered that to be a better outcome than her men engaged in battle and the specter of potentially thousands of our people being killed by a punishing response from the United States.
What kind of person is that? She was thinking steps ahead.
And everyone knows that if she had fired on American troops, there would have been not just one battleship coming back to Honolulu, but several of them. And there would have been hell. This much she knew, and this much the Americans demonstrated in other places in the world right at that time. You can ask people in the Philippines what the Americans did in order to hold on to that colony. So it's really that kind of personal courage that I think makes her such a significant model for Kanaka today, and for people who live in the world who see their own institutions betray them. We need to look and find ways to live through this without really succumbing simply to cynicism and despair, and learn how to live with these kinds of things and how to live lives that are valuable and productive.
And so, Jonathan Osorio, what do you think people need to know about Queen Liliʻuokalani as a person?
I hope that they know that she was a romantic, loving, exciting woman who wrote the most suggestive and erotic love songs, sometimes for others, sometimes really for herself and for her own entertainment and amusement. I hope they understand that she sort of straddled the demands and the expectations of the Christian church. You know, she was always a stalwart in whatever church she belonged to for Kauaihao for many years. I wish that they would know more about how she saw herself through all of this by reading her book, Hawaii's Story by Hawaii's Queen, because she's really, really clear in these pages what it was that her brother was trying to accomplish as king. As this island nation became more and more known in the world, how her brother really tried to navigate very, very difficult political waters, because the Americans, the British, the French, all in their turn had wanted basically to have possession of these islands, and how she understood the local rich white missionary descendants who controlled the sugar industry, how clearly she saw their intentions, how clearly she understood their own values and what they would stand for and what they would not stand for. I wish they knew how clearly she understood how dangerous her own position was when she became queen, and how she had to deal with a constitution that really limited her power, But she had sworn to uphold that Constitution, and she had sworn to uphold how that Constitution regulated the monarchy. What she did to try and change that Constitution was completely legal, seeking the support of her cabinet, making certain, believing that they were on board as she moved toward creating a better constitution for the kingdom. I wish people would know what a good political strategist she was. And I wish that we'd know how clearly I think she saw the future. She understood that if she didn't make Hawaii a conquered nation, I believe she really understood that we would always have the ability legally to claim the restoration of our sovereignty. And, you know, to do that, she had to surrender her own, right, queenship. She had to surrender that in order to protect our future. And I think that's exactly what she did. I wish people knew that about her.
So you think the Queen's surrender to the U.S., her refusal to fire on American troops, ended up preserving, in a sense, the options currently available to Hawaiians?
I do. I believe that this is partly what motivates us and partly what gives us the legal avenue that we have been on for, you know, the past 3 or 4 decades. And these are the kinds of things that we really are trying to celebrate here in the exhibit that we have created at Hamilton Library that will be up until October 15th. And really and truly, I hope people come and see this exhibit. It's on the ground floor of Hamilton Library. If you come on a Sunday, right, or a Saturday, I think if you come on a Sunday, parking is free. You can park almost anywhere, walk through the library, go into the bridge gallery, and see what has been created to commemorate Liliʻu as a person.
That's a cool exhibit. I like the photograph of the Queen when she was 15. That's great. And the 100th commemoration of her passing continues with a concert this Saturday, right?
So we shaped the concert around these four themes that you also see in the gallery. Makaukau, which means readiness. That's all the training that she went through, her own genealogy as a chief that prepared her for rule. Noʻeau, the grace and talent of this woman, really, which is reflected in her writing and in her music. Ku Ikapono, which means integrity. The way she really clearly understood what it was that people, that her people in the kingdom were really trying to secure, a peaceful and safe sovereignty for our nation, and her willingness to try and grasp that. And then courage, viva ole. In the end, she had to face basically the contempt of the provisional government, basically the absence of the United States. She had to face that as a lone woman, as a person alone. No army, no cabinet. And yet, at the same time, tens of thousands of Kanaka Maoli out in the public who were intensely loyal to her and would have done anything for her.
Mahalo, Jonathan Osorio from the Hawaii Nui Akea School of Hawaiian Knowledge. That dedication continues today, and we'll see it on stage tomorrow, no doubt. Ho'ohali Alia, Remembering Her Majesty, a special performance of Mele, Hula, and Hai Olelo at Kennedy Theater. That's Saturday, October 7th, 7 p.m. All proceeds from this event will go to scholarships for Native Hawaiian students at the University of Hawaii Manoa.
And mahalo, Noe Tanigawa, for that fascinating look at some of the Queen's story. That is The Conversation for this Friday, October 6th. Next week, we're back to regular programming, but today, it is the 10th and final day of our pledge drive, in case you missed that. We appreciate your support. We'll get an update on how things are going and a reminder of how you can contribute from Ray Cruz and Company at Pledge Central.